A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, it's Anoush here. If you're a regular listener of the New Statesman podcast, you'll know that we've been closely following the lead up to the Scottish elections on the 6th of May. These could be pivotal elections, not just for the next 4 years in Scottish politics, but potentially for the future of the United Kingdom. So for the next 4 weeks, we're going to do something a bit different. Every Wednesday, we'll publish a special episode, like the one you're about to hear, dedicated entirely to the latest developments in Scotland. Chris Deering, our Scotland editor, is going to take the reins for these bonus episodes. Alva, Stephen and I will pop up from time to time, along with some other of our New Statesman colleagues and a few special guests from the world of Scottish politics. It's going to be a fascinating few weeks in politics, so I hope you enjoy these extra episodes. I'll be back with Stephen and Alva in our next regular show, but for now, Chris Deering, over to you.
Thanks, Anoush. It's great to be here, and I'm really looking forward to these next few episodes. So, welcome to the New Statesman podcast's first Scottish election special. In this episode, we'll be discussing the state of play so far on the election trail and whether there's any sign that the all-powerful SNP could be reined in by the opposition parties.
They are an all-dominant establishment in Scotland now. I mean, they are hegemonic in Scotland. That can only last for so long without there being a reaction to it.
That's Blair McDougall, the Labour electoral strategist who led the successful Better Together campaign in 2014. He'll be joining me later in the show. First, what's been happening this week? Well, last night, party leaders gathered for the second televised debate.
Scotland did vote to stay in Europe, so what's our route to respecting the way people in Scotland voted in that Brexit referendum other than independence?
Yeah, that's your view. You are determined to open the wounds in the country that we had tried to close in the last few years. This is reckless.
The future of the country should be for people in Scotland to decide.
What people are going to see already tonight is bickering about old arguments, which is people's own interests, not the national interest.
There seems to be general agreement among those not pushing any particular candidate or party, that Anas Sarwar was again the best performer on the night.
If you speak to people right across the country, what they are worried about right now isn't actually the date of a referendum. What they're worried about right now is keeping their loved ones safe.
The new Scottish Labour leader's calm manner and positioning of himself as a reasoned and thoughtful alternative to the SNP or the Conservatives is impressing many, though whether this bears fruit in the polls remains to be seen. Douglas Ross, the Tory leader with the independence fixation, took his foot off the pedal somewhat and presented a gentler, even cuddlier version of himself.
What's most important in life? Spending time with family and a commitment to building a better future for the next generation.
Nicola Sturgeon was on the back foot at times, defending the SNP's 14-year record in government.
I think we took our eye off the ball on drugs deaths, and I've said as much to the Scottish Parliament.
Though she did make the good, and when you think about it, quite weird point, that she's the only one of the leaders explicitly saying she wants to be First Minister.
In asking you to re-elect me as First Minister, I promise you this, strong leadership to steer the country through the pandemic.
The debate came shortly after a forced hiatus in campaigning.
If I may ask you all to stand and to join me in a 1 minute silence.
Politicians agreed briefly to suspend their campaigns after just 2 weeks following the death of the Duke of Edinburgh. But one party in particular returned from the hiatus with a bang, the bang of a medieval cannon, that is.
And this demonstration of people power by the small folk of Scotland was the straw which broke the spine of English superiority.
Alex Salmond continued his attempt to recast himself as a returning nationalist hero with a video for his Alba Party, in which the actor Angus McFadyen portrays what I must say is a rather infirm-sounding Robert the Bruce. Whether breaking English spines is the kind of blood and soil message the modern nationalist movement will warm to, not to mention the wider electorate, is a moot point. I was also impressed by the Bruce's prediction that here and now people power will prevail, which showed an impressive grasp of modern terminology for a 14th century freedom fighter.
Alba will unite the clans.
I'm joined now by Ben Walker from the New Statesman's data journalism team. Ben's also the co-founder of the polling aggregator Britain Elects and runs the New Statesman's Scottish election poll tracker, which you can see on newstatesman.com. So, Ben, after 2 weeks of the campaign, where do the parties stand compared to how they began? Has there been any shift?
Not really. The debates look like they haven't changed the numbers particularly well. So before the campaign even began, the SNP were experiencing something short of a significant fall in support. Both the First Minister and her party were receiving poor marks over the Salmond Sturgeon saga, and that seems to have at least been partly responsible for both their drops in support and indeed a drop in support for independence too. So in the days leading up to the campaign, the numbers were mired with that. But now, a few weeks on, what fall the SNP saw seems to have been mostly, though not all, recuperated. Compared to the last election, the SNP are about 2 to 3 points down on what they achieved in the list vote. The Scottish Tories are likewise down 2 to 3 points. Scottish Labour are down only about 1 point, if that, which, according to our modelling, really throws open the potential for them to come second, beating the Tories. The Lib Dems, they're up by around 1 to 2 points, and the Greens, the party that looks set to be the biggest gainers of this election, though only relatively, are up 3 points. If the polls are right and the election was held today, the SNP would see their number of MSPs at Holyrood up by 3 seats because they'd make gains on the constituency vote. The Tories would be down 7 seats, Labour down only 1, and the Greens would be up 1.
Nicola Sturgeon's comment in the leaders' debate that she was the only political leader standing to actually be First Minister and be in government is true, of course. And really, the battle is for second place between Labour and the Conservatives. And the Tories are obviously banking on their anti-independence campaign to pull in those voters who really don't want another independence referendum, whereas Labour is attempting to move the campaign away from independence and leaning heavily on the impressive displays by their shiny new leader. Is this going to have any effect, do you think, or is the Tory focus on blocking independence and the SNP and Greens' desire for a referendum going to ensure it stays front and centre? I mean, what are the voters saying about their priorities? Do they align to the political parties?
Yeah, if you just looked at the debates, you would think that Anna Sowell was sort of defining the debate, that post-Indy, on subjects, not about independence. But really, the data shows not much shift. Anna Sowell has experienced what can only be described as a pretty good bounce in his own public image. He has impressed the public pretty well so far. The voters, both yes and no, don't have much that negative to say about him. But is he changing the political weather? No, there isn't really much to see there. What we are seeing in terms of issues most important to voters, independence is still top. It's always going to be top. It's been top since time immemorial. Well, since the SNP won their first election in 2007. Well, since the SNP got into government in 2007. But really, we're not seeing much. The most enthusiastic voters are those more likely to be concerned with the Constitution. Those not concerned with the Constitution are less likely to be enthusiastic voters. And so what you're going to see in polls is a potential at the moment for SNP and Conservative voters to be overstated a little bit because they are the most enthusiastic. There may be more Labour voters out there. There may be more Green and Lib Dem and maybe even Alba voters out there. But those least concerned with independence, according to the polls, are the least enthusiastic. That may change and the polls may get it wrong.
You talk about Alba and can we tell anything yet about the potential Alba performance? I mean, they're laying it on thicker than granny's porridge with that latest PPB. Is this likely to help them? What do they need to do to win seats? And who will it hurt if they do?
If I could say, I kind of have a bit of a weird hot take, which is that this kind of Robert the Bruce appeal, there's a demographic for that. There's a definite demographic for that kind of, like, you know, there's Robert Rue's kind of nationalist Scots who kind of believe in their blood and soil Scottish nationalism. Definitely exist out there. There is a market for the kind of Alba Party that is less Brexit, less EU friendly. They're just as pro independence, but less EU friendly. Let's just remember a great portion of the yes vote in 2014 did vote leave in the 2016 referendum. And if Nicola Sturgeon is sort of marketing herself as the first minister that will take Scotland, independent Scotland, back into the EU, that will turn a few voters off. Now, data. So Alba's been mentioned in a few polls so far, and in three polls, they're on 3%. On one, they're on 2%. And on one, they're on 6%. So a range of 2 to 6%. That is actually rather annoyingly on the boundary line between winning seats and not. So we don't know exactly where they are, but we know this. Alba need to have 5 or 6% of the vote in one region before they start winning seats. We don't know that yet. There is a potential that they could do really well in northeast Scotland around Aberdeenshire, Gordon, formerly Alex Salmond's constituency. But again, we don't have the data yet. What Alba need is 5 to 6% in one region for them to win a seat there. If they get 5 to 6% across the country, across the whole of Scotland, you're looking at them getting between 6 and 8 seats.
Thanks very much, Ben. You can keep up with the latest polling data on the New Statesman Scottish Election Poll Tracker, which you can find on newstatesman.com or just Google Scottish Election Tracker. We're offering a special discount on new subscriptions to the New Statesman for listeners to these podcasts. You can get 12 weeks for just £12 by visiting newstatesman.com/subscribe12. After the break.
Anas, I think, is kind of looking for an I agree with Nick moment. He recognises that rather than having an argument about the policy of independence, you have an argument about the process of the constitutional debate.
Political strategist Blair McDougall on whether Scottish Labour have a fighting chance under new leader Anas Sarwar.
Tired of ads barging into your favourite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Blair McDougall, a weathered Labour election strategist and the man who ran the successful Better Together campaign in 2014. Blair's new blog, Notes on Nationalism, has quickly become a must-read for its thoughts on the state of the political debate in Scotland and its insights into how this campaign is being fought. Welcome to the New Statesman podcast, Blair.
Thanks for having me.
Delighted as ever. Let's start by talking about these first weeks of the campaign. One thing that struck me from your writing is your analysis of how the SNP's position has changed in this election. So despite being in government for 14 years, they've previously managed to run in elections as if they are the opposition, as if they are the outsiders to the establishment. And your view is that this isn't proving possible this time round, and that instead they're being forced to defend themselves as a government and on the record that comes with that. Why do you think that is? What has changed?
Well, I think we should say first, you say their position has changed. Maybe their position hasn't changed, but their performance has. I think there's a few things. I think incumbency eventually comes for everybody in government. There comes a point where you just feel a little tired and you're a little too familiar to people. And I think they're at the beginnings of that. As a government, I think the other thing that's changed, and you saw a sign of that in the first leaders' debate when Nicola Sturgeon tried to play some of the old tunes about grievances around welfare reform and the impact of that. And Willie Rennie, the Lib Dem leader, had interrupted her to point out that actually, were it not for her delaying the devolution of welfare powers, those welfare powers would actually be within her control. So I think there's a feeling at the moment that there's issues that they are talking about which are about fixing things that problems that they've created. There are then problems they're trying to exploit, which I think increasing numbers of people now understand that they have the power to do something about it. And I think those two things are kind of coming together. I think they're lucky in their opponents. They've consistently been lucky in their opponents. I think that's beginning to change with the Labour Party. But they are still, I think if they are re-elected, and if they are re-elected handsomely, I think it will be without a huge sense of enthusiasm, as it perhaps has been in the past.
And they are, as you say, still miles ahead in the polls, and that seems unlikely to change too dramatically in the next few weeks. But then the SNP have been through such a turbulent period. We've had the Salmond affair, real divisions in the nationalist movement to the point that new and competing parties have been set up, including Alex Salmond's ALBA or ALBA party, however we're pronouncing it today. There's a sense that while Nicola Sturgeon's opponents are in the opposition parties, her enemies are on her own side. You're a Labour strategist. How do you take advantage of this scenario?
Well, I think what's interesting to me is that when you are faced with division in your own side, you've got a choice what to do. You can be essentially strong or weak in response to it. And Nicola Sturgeon, the creation of ALBA is a symptom of something rather than a cause of it. For many months, there's been this chorus of dissent within the SNP, and the very strong, very disciplined, very centralised message that we saw, for example, in 2014, is gone. You know, it's much more kind of thousand flowers bloom responses to any question now. And she had a choice. She could have stood up to that internal dissent and said, look, we need to park a referendum for a few years. That could have been the message. And instead, the day before the election campaign started, she published a referendum bill which said that they would try and hold that referendum within 2.5 years. And that felt like she was choosing her strategy for an internal rather than an external audience. The polls suggest that on the timing of a referendum, leaving aside the kind of what people think about how they would vote in a referendum, that there's about a third of the population who support that policy of doing it quickly. Most other people will tend to choose either maybe in a few years' time or maybe never sort of position. And she's chosen to camp in the position of going sooner rather than later, which feels like she has one eye on that internal fight within the SNP, the kind of impatient internal activists. I think I described it as being, she had a choice between choosing to be Tony Blair and standing up to the people within her own coalition who were maybe against where the voters were, and she's kind of chosen to be Jeremy Corbyn. It feels like she's going into this election believing that her core is mobilised enough and energetic enough that it will get her over the line, rather than worrying about those swing voters too much. And it might be that she gets away with that. It might be that Labour haven't got enough time yet to maybe capitalise on Anas Sarwar's improved leadership ratings, that though they won't transfer over in time to the Labour Party. But she might get a surprise. We've seen it in the recent past, in the 2017 election, where the voters felt that she was needed reminding that they weren't quite as enthusiastic as she was at the prospect of leaving the UK, even if they were curious about it. So we'll see what happens. As you say, I think the likelihood is they'll get re-elected and re-elected handsomely. But they do feel internally focused and they do feel very, very tired.
I suppose that's one of the issues is that, we can point to misjudgments that we might feel that Nicola Sturgeon is making. We can point to the crises that the party has going on inside it and in the wider nationalist movement. You know, Douglas Ross, the leader of the Scottish Conservatives, has been battering away at the SNP on the union largely for a while now. Anas Sarwar, the new leader of the Scottish Labour Party, is obviously just beginning his journey and hasn't had time to make too much of an impact. But despite all of this, and as you say, in 2016, the electorate gave Nicola Sturgeon, made her the largest party, but they didn't give them the overall majority. Yet, it looks like they might well get the overall majority this time for a fourth term in government, which is kind of unthinkable in the normal political swing of things. So what's going on there, and how do you pull that back? Is it a matter of just waiting, just giving it time and preparing yourself to be an alternative government in due course? Or do you think there are things that can be done by the opposition parties that they haven't done so far that can really land some blows and cut that lead?
I'd say three things. The first thing is there is a centrality to the SNP strategy, which is always about the inevitability of independence. Even when they lost in 2014, they immediately transitioned into a message which was, well, we didn't win this time, but we will win. And too many people in the opposition buy into that. Too many people accept the narrative of their strength. In the last 10 opinion polls, support for independence hasn't gone above 50%. In the most recent one, it's at 45. It's literally where they were. Now, there is a deeper problem of confidence on the pro-union side, which needs to be addressed. But I think the first thing about tackling the SNP is not to buy into their narrative, not to reinforce their narrative. The second thing I'd say is, and you mentioned Douglas Ross, the Conservatives have a strategy that's worked for them. They recognise that there is, you know, about 30% of the population in Scotland who are unionists in an identity sense. They are not just voting to stay in the UK out of a sense of pragmatism, but out of a sense of identity. And they've decided they're going to try and cannibalise as many of those votes as possible. That's fine as a strategy for being the second party, but it's only ever going to be a strategy to be the opposition. That's true in simple numbers terms because they're not seeking in any way in their strategy to reach out to soft SNP voters. But it's also true in terms of the frame of Scottish politics, because the more you make Scottish politics only about the constitution, the more you are gifting the SNP the ability to define Scottish politics on their terms, which is constitutional terms, which is identity politics. So I think you see Anas Sarwar now trying to break that frame. Previous Labour leaders have done it as well, have made an effort to try to break out of that that constitutional frame. Hasn't worked in the past. We found ourselves as a Labour Party in no man's land, while the people fighting the identity wars are shelling each other over our heads, and we get kind of squeezed out of the debate. What I think is maybe interesting at the moment, apart from, you know, the issues of them that come with them having been incumbents for so long and the feeling of tiredness, is that for so long independence represented something which felt hopeful. It was a blank canvas for people who wanted to change something in their lives. You've now, with the pandemic, I think, for the first time, got Labour have something which feels similar to that blank canvas. The post-pandemic moment feels like a fresh start. And that, I think, has gifted Anas Sarwar the ability to kind of sound more hopeful, more positive in the way that he's talking about the future. And it's also enabled him, I think, to grab onto the kind of fundamental values of what's kind of underneath the pro-UK argument. And I think it's something we weren't terribly good at, actually, in 2014, where so the yes side would always talk about independence in terms of the fundamental value. You know, you move out of your house, you try and become independent, you want to be independent in your personal finances and stuff like that. Now Anas is beginning to talk about the idea of being together as being a fundamental value as well. And that's maybe what the pandemic has done. It's given us an ability to talk about being divided from one another, being a negative on a sort of deeper human level.
And as you say, Scottish Labour has this brand new leader in Anas Sarwar. So far, the signs, I think, are pretty positive. People in the Labour Party that I know seem quite optimistic, quite upbeat about his performance. In the first televised leaders' debate, he was seen by many as the winner. He has an easy manner, and it seems a clear path that he wants to follow too. He obviously doesn't have a lot of time to make an impression on the voters, and Labour's on, I think, 24 seats at Holyrood at present, and Anas has said that it'll be a struggle even to hold on to these. You know, he's not promising the moon at this point, and given the squeeze between the Tories campaigning on no to independence and the SNP campaigning on yes, how does Labour get a hearing from the electorate after so long where it really didn't feel particularly central to the debate? And how does it carve out a distinct position for itself just in the next few weeks, far less beyond that?
Yeah, so I think I was thinking about this in the lead up to the last debate, and Anas, I think, is kind of looking for an I agree with Nick moment. You know, we remember in 2010, you had David Cameron and Gordon Brown sort of slugging each other, and Nick Clegg coming through the middle with a more of a, hey, can't we all just get along message. And I think that an element of that is being more positive. There was an element of, wouldn't it be nice to have something different? Wouldn't it be nice if we all got along in Nick Clegg's positioning then? But there was also a really strongly kind of almost anti-political element to that Nick Clegg messaging in 2010, where it was about, you know, these two either side of me are a headache. They are droning on with the same old arguments, and wouldn't it be just nice to have a break from this? And I think that's where Anas is trying to position himself, is that he recognises that rather than having an argument about the policy of independence, you have an argument about the process of the constitutional debate. So even people who are a substantial minority of the people who are supporting independence when they're asked the binary question in opinion polls, I think will think, do I really want the headache of the antagonism, the fighting? Do I really want to go back to that binary division of Scottish society so quickly? And I think that's what he is trying to get hold of. Every moment that goes by in the campaign makes it less likely that he's able to cut through, and that's why I think these debates are so important. They're one of the few moments where he gets to do that. It was so important that he won the first debate. He's got to do that in the next STV debate as well. But you know, if you lose a week of campaigning with Prince Philip, you know, for example. These weeks go by very, very quickly. But I don't think anyone in the Labour Party is viewing Anas's leadership as something you'd come to a judgment on at the end of the campaign. I think it is about setting a frame for what happens next rather than necessarily looking at the scorecard on the 7th of May.
Well, while we have you here, it would seem remiss not to talk a bit about the Constitution having run better together in 2014. Much of the territory has changed since then. The UK has left the European Union. Boris Johnson is Prime Minister. We've been through the Jeremy Corbyn era. The consequence of this election, if the SNP either wins an overall majority on its own or with, say, the Greens or ALBA, will be a demand for a second independence referendum, and that feels like it will dominate the next parliament if that's the case. How would you advise the UK government to respond to that situation? Can a flat no work, or are they going to have to play cleverer than that in the response?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that for me this is a political question. And the decision on it should be a political one rather than worrying too much about the other aspects of it. As you say, a lot has changed since 2014. We've had economic crisis, we've had health crisis, we've had really a political crisis in British politics with what's happened to the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. But we should keep the heat. They are still only with everything that the pro-union side has handed them on a plate, still at 45% of the raw vote. The problem is on our side. The problem is one of confidence and of leadership on our side of it. One of the lessons, I think, David Cameron's in the news a lot at the moment for less positive reasons, but one of the things he did very well was refusing to be the villain that they wanted him to be. You know, he refused to take the bait every time Salmon demanded he debate with them. He allowed them to own the process of the referendum itself, so that there was never any room for grievance. For me, I think that's got to be a consideration at the other side of this. And I would say the smart thing to do on the other side of this would be to, instead of a blanket no, is to say not never, but not now. And to challenge, and this is where maybe Boris Johnson's not in a great position to make this challenge, but it, certainly the Labour Party is, to challenge the SNP to say, if you are really serious about this, okay, let's get over the pretense that you think you're going to be ready to do this in the next, you know, 18 months, 2 years. If you're really serious about this, you will have set out a plan for how the new currency will operate. You will have set out a plan for how a new border with England will work, given the EU continuity has disappeared. And you will have set out a serious plan for how Scotland's public services will be funded. Now, what that has the capability to do is to frame the debate away from where the SNP want it to be, which is Scotland's right to choose, and into whether this is actually a good idea or not. And I think when you get into the weeds of the detail of independence, I think people walk away from it. I think there was a really revealing bit of messaging in the SNP's recent party political broadcast, where rather than making the case for independence, they were entirely saying, they say, they being Boris Johnson and those horrible Tories, they say you can't have a referendum. And that is straightforward reverse psychology. And any parent knows you only use reverse psychology when you're trying to sell someone on something they don't actually want. You know, it's like telling your kids, I bet you can't finish that broccoli, you know. They know that people are not in any sort of hurry to have this referendum. So they want it to be a debate about whether Scotland is allowed by the rest of the UK to have it. And the only way to win that fight is not to have it. So you don't give, you know, the SNP a referendum, but you don't have a blanket no. You say, well, look, let's have a conversation about this, but you wouldn't expect us to say yes to a referendum until you have done all of your homework.
And realistically, there isn't going to be a Better Together campaign next time. The coming together of the unionist parties in 2014 didn't really have great consequences, maybe for Labour in the aftermath. So the sense is that we'll have Better Together campaigns rather than a campaign. Is that how you see it? And how do you produce a united voice then if you're...
Yes and no. I think for... a broad-based campaign is a legal necessity because you can't spend money in a referendum without one. You need something which is an umbrella campaign. That doesn't necessarily need to be a cross-party campaign. It can be, you know, a community-based campaign. And I think that's what you're more likely to see this time than last time. In truth, I think, notwithstanding the politics of that, the sort of scar tissue that Labour has of the post-referendum kind of fallout probably pushes them towards something that sounds more like that anyway. I think you probably want something that's a bit more insurgent this time. I mean, we started this conversation talking about the SNP having been, you know, 14-year incumbents at the time of the next referendum. You know, they might be sort of going on 20-year incumbents if there is another referendum. And so I think you would want something that felt more like a scrappy insurgent than the, you know, representation of an alternative establishment. I think there's a... one of the things, and it maybe squares the whole conversation, one of the things I think that unites the SNP's feeling of tiredness and looking forward in terms of the constitutional debate is the fact that they are an all-dominant establishment in Scotland now. I mean, they are hegemonic in Scotland. That can only last for so long without there being a reaction to it. And I think there is an opportunity, particularly for Labour, to tell a story about being the reaction to that establishment. And you start to see the raw material for that every day. There's you know, little scandals here and there, little approaches to the use of power, which leave a bad taste in the mouth. So I think the ammunition is there. It's whether there's someone to tell that story.
Great. Thanks very much, Blair.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode. I'll be back next Wednesday for another Scottish election special. Stephen, Anoush and Alva are here on Friday and again on Tuesday. Until next time. You've been listening to a special episode of the New Statesman podcast. I'm Chris Dearon. You can read more of the New Statesman Scottish election coverage at newstatesman.com and follow me on Twitter at Chris Dearon. This podcast was produced by Chris Stone, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.